This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. This week, we bring you a forum on the effects of climate change in Utah, and in particular, its effects on Utah's ski industry. Officially adopting the phrase, the greatest snow on Earth, over four decades ago in 1975, does Utah, in 2019, still hold the mantle of the greatest snow on Earth? Thanks to an especially long and wet winter this year, Utah ski resorts have seen record snowfall, with Snowbird extending its season all the way to July 4th for the fifth time in its 48-year history. Contrastingly, with a severe heat wave in Western Europe and elsewhere, June of 2019 has been on average the hottest June on record, with this July potentially topping it as the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. While Utah has not seen the kind of heat waves experienced in Western Europe and the American Midwest this summer, these changing temperature trends could have a significant impact on the skiing and winter tourism industries in Utah. A variety of other factors are also cause for concern when it comes to snowfall in Utah's mountains. Climate scientists say that temperatures are rising in Utah, but we're also seeing less dry years on average, with both contributing to the danger of avalanches as the snow rapidly melts in spring. Meanwhile, University of Utah research has raised the alarm about dust storms from a drying Great Salt Lake, and how that dust can cause snow to melt earlier than usual. Today, a panel of scientists and Olympic athletes tackle the question, can Utah's ski industry survive climate change? Speaking on the panel is Mackenzie Skiles, assistant professor in the University of Utah's Geography Department, Maura Olivos, ecologist and director of the Alta Environmental Center, Leah Lang, a member of the University of Utah's Nordic ski team, Jackie Wiles, two-time Olympian and a member of the U.S. ski team, and moderating the discussion is research scientist Dr. Peter Veals in the University of Utah's Department of Atmospheric Science. This week's forum was recorded on February 7, 2019, and aired earlier this year.
So just to kind of get everyone on the same page here, as Pedro mentioned, we'll be discussing climate change and skiing in Utah. And it's no secret that our snowfall is well known as some of the best in the world here, and it's been instrumental in the state's tourism and ski industries, our hosting of the 2002 Olympics, and then even securing the USOC's bid for the 2030 Olympics here in Utah. However, climate change threatens the long-term stability of the ski industry. And just to get everyone on the same page, a brief overview of the science here, the current state of the science. So global CO2 levels have varied between 180 and 280 parts per million over the last 800,000 years. And that includes those 180 values are ice ages, and the 280 would be more typical of a warm period. As of this year, the current global average is 410 parts per million. So that's unprecedented in the last 800,000 years. And most of that is attributed to human emissions. So as a result, the average global temperature has already warmed approximately 2 degrees Fahrenheit to date. And a similar increase has been observed so far throughout the state of Utah. Depending on trends in future human CO2 emissions and various feedbacks in the atmosphere, we can expect somewhere between another 2 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit of warming over the next century. And as far as Utah is concerned, recent research suggests that our higher elevation ski resorts may be resilient to some increase in temperatures for some period to come, but our low elevation resorts and Olympic venues will likely see a dramatic increase over just even the coming decades in the amount of winter precip that falls as rain. And then furthermore, the duration of the winter snowpack, the meltout date and the accumulation date of the winter snowpack has already been decreasing throughout most of the West, and that decrease is expected to continue in the foreseeable future. So with that in mind, our panel here is going to discuss the future of the ski industry in Utah, the threat that climate change poses to the winters, and things that we can do about it. So I just want to start off, I guess, with each panelist. If you could just share a little bit of your experience so far with climate change and the ski industry. So Dr. Skiles, we can start with you.
Sure, I'll go ahead and start. So I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, skiing a lot, and that's how I sort of ended up here. I managed to turn my interest in snow and skiing and science into a career as a snow hydrologist. And so it's two sides for me. I really enjoy skiing for fun. And I study both the accumulation and timing of snowmelt and how that's changing over time. And I use satellites to monitor how snow extent is changing over time. So, you know, I can state definitively that I know that snow extent has been declining over the last 30 years. And so that impacts both our hydrology, because that's where all of our water comes from, and our climate.
My name is Jacqueline Wiles. I am an alpine skier from Portland, Oregon. I've skied my whole life. Started when I was 2 years old, skiing and racing when I was five, and just always loved being in the mountains and the snow. Had a great passion for it, and I over the years have seen the change of the snow fields, not only in Portland with Mount Hood, just seeing over time how it's been less and less. The glacier on Mount Hood, we've had a little bit less every summer with how long we can ski. And then I've traveled a bunch where in the summer we're always chasing snow. We're chasing winter in the southern hemisphere, and all the glaciers seem to be getting a little bit smaller and smaller. So as an avid lover of snow and winter sports, it's been very apparent that there's just a little bit less every year, and it seems kind of scary to think if this keeps getting worse, who knows what, you know, our kids and our grandkids and the future generations might not have the same experiences that we do. So excited to be here and learning more about climate change. And yeah, thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm on the University of Utah ski team here, and I started skiing at a really young age too, right when I could walk. And I grew up in Park City, so I'm used to seeing lots of high snowfall winters. And then these past couple years and like my last years of high school racing there, like there were days where we had to run and we couldn't ski because there weren't trails and everything, or it was raining and stuff that we never have seen in Park City before. And traveling to races, and it's we are racing on like can't warm up at all, and then we're racing on a track that's like been put in by trucks from snow that has fallen so far away, and it's so different than what it used to be. It's really, ski racing is becoming really hard with the less snow, which is hard to see now too with so much snow outside. But
so I did not grow up skiing. I came to Utah to learn how to ski, so my short view of it has only been since about 2002, the year after the Olympics. Although I did come here the year of the Olympics and skied that 100 inches in 100 days, or 100 inches in 100 hours. So having a completely different view, and I also came from Oregon where I didn't really have much snow. It wasn't in my family or culture to ski. But being here, since I've been here in the short time span, I have seen some significant changes and differences since 2002. One of the things I would say that our ski area is experiencing, probably all, we're along the same lines with all the skiers in Utah, is we haven't been able to be as reliable, or the time or the start date when we open is not as reliable. We used to say, all right, we're gonna open the week before Thanksgiving, no matter what. There was never any issues with temperature. Precipitation's always been here and there, but we've had snowmaking since the 80s. Most ski areas have. So we always had the temperature then to at least make some snow. But that has not been as reliable. So we're kind of lucky. We've kind of pushed our hopes to every year to be open maybe right after Thanksgiving or right during Thanksgiving, so it's a week later. Additionally, and that's because we, even if there is no precipitation, we still have to have those temperatures to make snow and just make them on our base, our primary lines down off of each lift. And then one of the bigger things, which which really bums me out, I guess, is the type of snow. We used to, even back 2002 till about 2011 or so, consistent, and I'm sure it was like that before I came into Utah or was introduced to skiing, but that consistent powder snow, the really light, airy snow that you couldn't even make a snowball with. And that was the one thing I did learn, is how to ski powder. I'm not a very good racer or hard pack skier, but I can ski powder. And I love it. And I love choking on the powder and breathing the powder. And that type of consistent, light, airy powder, we just don't see as often as more. Every time we get a storm, we're not necessarily getting that type of powder. It's a lot heavier, a lot wetter, and I'm sure Mackenzie's got lots of info to help support that, but it's different. And so now, I shouldn't be complaining, because you know how to ski this snow, like now wetter, harder packed snow here. And maybe I'm just spoiled, because all I've ever really skied is Alta, but so yeah, it's changed. End dates haven't been affected as much, but we are, but it does rely again on snowpack. So we haven't really had, and we've only had an average year reached 500 inches maybe last season over the last 7 years, I think. So we have a different start date and start time when we count, you know, measure our snow. But for us, with our records, we've only had one average reach that 500 inches in the last 7 years. So again, I don't know what that's going to do to our overall average, but those are what I have seen in a short time span.
Thanks, Maura. So I'm going to piggyback right off of that and give a question to Dr. Skiles here, because I think this is very relevant right now with a foot of wonderful snow outside of our door, a fat snowpack, a great winter going on. Can you sort of explain the difference? You know, it's easy when you have a low winter, right, to say, oh, you know, this is climate change. And then if you go by that same reasoning, it's hard when there's a fat winter to explain to people maybe that are skeptical, you know, that climate change is real and it's happening. Can you explain the difference between weather and climate for us? And then sort of the difference between inferring climate from one winter at one point to a global average and a trend that is observed over tens or hundreds of years? Because I think that might be helpful for a lot of the non-science types here.
Sure. I think that we all kind of roll our eyes when we hear people say, like, oh, it's negative 30 in Chicago. That means that climate change isn't happening. I just saw some people roll their eyes right now. So the one event in one day or even one year doesn't equal climate. So climate is long-term trends, and climate change doesn't mean that everything's just going to keep declining or warming consistently over time. I think climate change actually equals climate variability. So you'll see more lower years and more higher years as things get a little out of balance with the climate. So the way that we really look at trends is to look at hopefully 10 years or more, what's happening at the decadal scale to see. So you'll get variability from year to year, but if you look at the trend over time, if that's decreasing, which it has been for snow extent, particularly in the spring months, so we know that snow extent has declined over the last 30 years in April, May, and June over the northern hemisphere. Once you see those declines over the last 30 years, you can state that we know snow extent is declining, and we can attribute that to a number of factors, including a warmer climate.
Thanks. Yeah, I feel like that's a common misconception, and I think it's especially exacerbated by the fact, too, that humans are not always great data sources on snowfall. You know, I mean,
it's very true.
You're going to remember these big dumps of snow, but you're not sitting there counting every year the date of the meltout of the snowpack or the number of storms that are rain versus snow or things
right.
Like that.
And I think that a great example is I did my PhD and spent some time doing research in California, and I was in the Sierra Nevada both during the lowest year on record and the highest year on record, 2015 and 2017. Wow. Basically wore the bookends of the record in the Sierra Nevada, and those happened a year apart from each other. So the climate is just getting more variable over time. We're seeing the impact of climate change, but in any given year, you can't necessarily say what's happening over the long-term trend. And then, you know, I think we tend to remember those extremes. We can say like, oh, I remember that last year, you know, we weren't skiing good snow until February. You know, but I remember when I first came to Utah in 2005, most of the ski resorts were open by Halloween. And that's the year that I remember the most. So, yeah.
And that could still, even in this warmed climate since 2005, that could still happen.
That could definitely still happen.
Because that's weather, that's 1 year, and that's not a multi-decadal trend. Right. Yeah, thanks for that. So another sort of topic here is that would be global climate change. There's some interesting local climate change that can happen in areas of the Mountain West, and you're really well positioned to talk about this with your research. So dust on snow from some of these ranges that have deserts to their south or west, that can be an example of a local climate change. What does that do to the snow, these dust events, and what causes them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think a lot of times it's really easy to attribute a changing snowpack to just a warming climate, but the story is never really that simple. So what happens in the springtime is that we get longer days, and it's actually the sunlight that melts snow. It's not air temperature that melts snow. We often correlate those two because days get warmer as we get longer days. And so if you get anything that makes the snowpack darker, that darker snowpack will absorb more sunlight. And when it absorbs more sunlight, it will melt faster. So in the Western US particularly, but also globally, something that happens typically in the spring is dust deposition. I'm sure you guys have all seen a dust event where the days get kind of hazy. And then if you're regular skiers, I'm sure you've seen those dust layers at the snow surface. And when the snow gets darker, it melts faster. And in places like the Southern Colorado Rockies, the dust there is coming from the Southern Colorado Plateau. And it's this really dark red, iron-rich sort of Southern Utah color dust. And dust deposition there accelerates snowmelt by a month on average and up to 2 months. In really extreme dust years. And we know that this isn't just a background impact. Dust has always been an aerosol, but it's impacted by human activity and it's exacerbated by drought. So we know that anything that breaks apart surface soils like grazing or oil and gas development or off-highway vehicle use leads to more dust deposition in the mountains, and that leads to accelerated melt. And when you get accelerated melt, you can actually change the magnitude of water that you get from the snowpack, initiating a feedback cycle that can lead to more drought. And then here in the Wasatch, we have the dust sources that come from human activity and land disturbance and even fires. But we also have a really sort of unique dust source here, which is the Great Salt Lake. So the Great Salt Lake has been shrinking ever since people have settled in the Salt Lake Valley. And as we take more water upstream, the Great Salt Lake is shrinking and there's no water protections for the Great Salt Lake. There's no minimum lake level. And so the dry lake bed keeps growing in size. And we were able to show in 2017 that one of dust event that originated in part from the Great Salt Lake dry lake bed advanced snowmelt here by a week. So it's
just
not
one event.
Just one event. And in combination, we had five dust events in 2017. But that one event accounted for half of all dust that was deposited. And so that's kind of a unique, it's not necessarily directly related to climate change. It's more related to water use upstream and the lack of protections for the Great Salt Lake. But it's definitely exacerbated by drought. And I think it's important to point out that it's not always just warming temperatures. The feedbacks here are more complicated than just increasing air temperature.
Right. And to the skiers too, to Leah and Jackie, Have you noticed in your international travels, are there other regions where you notice these dust on snow events, or is that something you've only really seen in Utah? Because, you know, it like Dr. Skiles was mentioning, it really comes out in the spring. You know, you really start to see the brown snow in the spring. But have either of you noticed any of that in your travels?
Yeah, definitely. I raced in Romania a couple years ago, and it got really windy, and there was no snow, and they had such a trouble keeping the snowpack because every day it would be so windy, and then it'd get covered with dust, and then also they didn't want us skiing on that bad of snow, and it was melting the snow, and then they had to bring in more snow. It wasn't snowing, and it was warm, windy.
Yeah, same. We see it frequently. We're always skiing in the spring, and every day it seems you get a little bit less and less snow and covered a little bit more with dust and dirt. And obviously not only is it kind of hard to ski on that, it gets a little sticky, but it's crazy how quickly you see the snow go away throughout, you know, a couple months of skiing. And that's interesting. I never realized because of the dust covering snow, how it attracts the sun more, making it. So that's really cool. So that makes a lot of sense because you see more and more dust and it really correlates with quite a bit of decrease of snow. I've seen it obviously a lot on Mount Hood, but quite a bit in Chile we're skiing. And you see a lot, I think a lot of it, there's a lot of dust around up in like Portillo that gets covered on the slopes. And every year it's been harder and harder to ski in the spring because it happens more and more each year. And it's been harder for us to find training in the spring, and everywhere we go, there's quite a bit of dust on all the spots.
Mm-hmm. And Maura, have you noticed at Alta, in your time there, more dust in the springtime?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's borne out by the trends too, right? Mm-hmm. And what's observed, yeah.
Yeah, and we, to try to take care of some of that, especially the base area, we do a lot of snow storage, and then when it gets really ugly, we'll take out that other snow that we've buried and lay it on top of the base area so it looks a little cleaner and fresher. Of course, it only lasts a few days because the albedo effect, and so but no, it's definitely it's definitely an issue. It hasn't necessarily affected our operational period yet. We just kind of ski through it because we end before. We don't ski all the way to the end of the snow because then it gets snowpacked. There's a lot of other safety issues and so on. Mm. But on the more ecological side of it in Alta, because Albion Basin is a very popular area for wildlife and wildflowers, and it's part of my primary management effort as well, is when we do have an early snow melt, it does affect the habitats and the plant communities pretty significantly. And I've seen that. We've had years where the snow has melted weeks in advance than we had anticipated, even on low snow years. And a lot of it is the combination between the dust and just how much sunlight we've been getting in the storms. But, you know, obviously there's a lot more complexity to it. But when we lose that snowpack, even just 2 or 3 weeks sooner, and sometimes even 1 week, it truly affects the vegetation that summer. And what we see, like I've seen plants just get crusty by the end of June, and then there's no flowers at the end of July. So it's not just the ski season, but it's our entire watershed that has the effect on, and then of course water supply and so on, but I'm sure Mackenzie can speak more to that.
So sorry, just a follow-up to that. With the ecological effects and the plants, is that something that Alta is involved with? Do you bring scientists up there to look at the effects on plant life up there? And I know the wildflowers are a big draw economically too, I think, in the summer. people come up there a lot for that.
We're trying to make it economically beneficial. Most people come up there because it's a free area. So
it's the opposite.
Yeah, and we've never had any summer operations until recent, this last summer. So it's we're trying to figure that out. We're managing the area now more like a park and trying to provide proper education and etiquette for our novice visitors that come up and tell them not to pick the flowers. But going to, you know, sorry, what was the question again?
Oh, that's fine. It was just you. I think you answered it adequately.
Okay.
It was just whether some of these effects that last further into the summer, like on plant life, how that sort of affects things. But
but bringing people up. So mm-hmm. I don't go out and search for researchers, but we have open doors. So any research, and McKenzie's done some studies up in mm-hmm. Alta as well. But we open our doors to anyone who would like to come up and do any additional research, because we don't claim to, ski area. We know how to run a ski area, but we don't necessarily know all the science behind, managing this watershed. That's why we rely heavily on our partners and education facilities like the University of Utah to come in and provide additional information so that we could use that to help guide our management efforts. So we're very open to it. We just, most of the work that we do is very kind of baseline stuff, like the recovery of areas that have been disturbed and so on.
Right. Okay.
And I'll just say real quick, ALTA has been a great partner for research and both snow hydrology and snow science, not just with me, but over time. So they're really supportive of that.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today we are re-airing a panel discussion on climate change's impact on Utah ski industry, given on February 7th, 2019. Here again is the panel's moderator, Dr. Peter Veals, research scientist for the University of Utah's Department of Atmospheric Science.
So, now that we've sort of covered the science, I wanted to shift gears a little bit more to the economics of the ski industry here in Utah. And I think sort of the presence of our two panelists here, Jackie and Leah, speaks to this. What sort of a role does skiing play culturally and economically in Utah? Like I said, I think your presence here probably speaks to that, but maybe you can add some more on that.
Yeah, I think there's so many people that are involved in the ski industry, whether you don't even see it or not, not only skiers, but you have people that work for, hotels, businesses, transportation, lodging. There's so many people that are affected within the ski industry that you don't realize. So I think it definitely affects the economy and bringing in money to these areas all around the world. And it's tough to see. With talking with a bunch of ski industry leaders in Europe, they just say how much it's declined already just in the past decade, a significant decrease. And when you're talking about snow blowing machines, it seemed like for a while they brought those in, but it was kind of a Band-Aid for a while. Like, it definitely helped. So I think it didn't really show people that there was a big change happening, because it kind of covered that up. But as temperatures get higher, it seems that, that's not always going to work. And you obviously still need it to be cold enough for you to be able to produce man-made snow. So there's a lot of people in the industry that I think will be affected for it, not only just skiers, but everyone, from ski manufacturers and tourism and the people that live in these areas, the people come to ski. So, even the ski racing sport, we've seen a big decrease in our industry. So it's been really sad to see. There's still a lot of support, especially in Europe, for racing, but it's definitely taken a pretty big decline, and it's hard to see, but it's great to hear that there's a lot of people that are trying to get the word out and trying to make a difference.
I think it's hard here, too, like with the growing programs of ski, bringing up children skiing and snowboarding, that because there's less snow, they're less likely to put the children into the programs, which then that's a huge decrease coming from the young and also sponsors and all the people that are involved. It's huge.
Yeah, and Maura, it seems like you can probably speak to this. I mean, Alta economically and the Cottonwoods economically to this area seem like pretty heavy hitters, both economically and culturally as well, too, to sort of our identity as a state.
Well, I may surprise you on this. Because we are higher elevation and we've consistently had snow every year for as long as I can think of, we've actually seen an increase in skier visits. But that's because we're taking advantage of our poor neighbors in other states who haven't been able to open. So there is still, and I think you hit it right on, you know, the nail, there is still currently a large number of skiers nationally and maybe even internationally. So if areas are suffering that don't have snow, and they don't even necessarily care about the quality of it. I mean, we still, in comparison, have really high quality snow, but we've been open. And just by sheer luck, because we're one of the few places open throughout, and this is kind of the Utah Intermountain region, even parts of California, we're getting those skier visits. So we're compensating for the loss other places. Now, how long we can go at that with that trend, I don't know, because then, yes, you're exactly right. Kids aren't going to learn how to ski in these little or these lower elevation areas. That's where you get your skiers. And you know, if you have a generation or even 5 years without any new skiers, what does that do to us 5, 10, 15 years down the line? Those are the questions we don't know yet. And we don't know what sort of, you know, how many skiers are going to be able or are going to have to close down in the next 10, 20 years. But then at the same time, there's more questions than answers, really. You look at Utah as one of the fastest growing states in the country. And you would think with that, you also get, as you get higher population, you maybe might be getting more skiers. But that's a huge maybe. We don't know what sort of activity, because Utah's got so many recreation opportunities that, you know, it's whatever they choose, but we would hope they would want to come and ski and enjoy their watershed and learn about their national forests. We hope, but we can't rely on that. So there's just a lot of questions than answers.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there was actually a study done recently on past and possible Olympic venues and their climate resilience. And I think Utah was near the top because of what you mentioned, because we have a higher elevation continental climate. We're going to do better, at least until, you know, eventually that resilience runs out if you warm enough. But I think in the near and middle term, it seems like it could actually be beneficial to be one of the venues that are faring better under this like low to moderate amounts of warming. But then eventually, I think when you're talking end of the century, that's when your Alta and snowbirds start to have trouble. But that's an interesting thought, that as lower elevation or warmer, more coastal locations start to become less viable as Olympic venues, it could temporarily be beneficial for Utah as an Olympic venue.
Yeah, what does it do to the Olympic events?
Right.
Will we have skiers? Will we have anyone to compete? There's lots more questions. Yeah, mm-hmm. Too many.
Yeah, and
I just want to say something about that. So like with the like 2030 Olympics, like cross country skiing in particular, it has a maximum altitude that you can race at. So that's becoming a huge issue because we can't race at Alta. Like we have to race in elevations of Salt Lake, but like where are we going to race?
I didn't realize that. What do you know off the top of your head? What the maximum altitude?
It's like 6,000 feet, maybe even less than 6,000.
2,000 meters.
Okay.
Yeah, 2,000 meters. So, like, 66. The 2002 Olympics was at Soldier Hollow, and the highest hill is the highest it can be globally. So.
Really?
Yeah, and like
I did not know that. That's
and they
really
couldn't
interesting.
We couldn't ski there this December because it wasn't cold enough for them to blow snow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I don't know how they're gonna like.
Yeah.
2030,
well, and coincidentally, like, I think Soldier Hollow, yeah. aside like, from the indoor venues down in the valley, I think Soldier Hollow is the lowest elevation outdoor venue of the Salt Lake Olympic complex.
Yeah.
So even with that, it's still near the max for what it can
yeah,
be.
Yeah, like it can't be in Park City. It can't be up at
mm-hmm. Well, summer. It can't right yeah. now, but those are, then you're getting to the next step, the adaptability into building your resilience. So it's like building capacity. And the Olympics, along with a lot of many other organizations, including the skiers, have to start thinking, well, can we continue to abide by these standards? Do we need to push the elevation up so that we can continue this sport and continue it being a part of our Olympic event? So a lot, again, it's going to take potential policy change to adapt, but then hopefully policy on the other side of things too.
Right. Yeah, so eventually it seems like then the International Olympic Committee will have to change those rules potentially.
Yeah. It's hard to change those rules though because most of Europe isn't that high, so they never race at altitude.
Right. It's
and
a fairness.
Yeah,
it's a fairness deal.
Like yep. yeah, so it's odd that it's coming back.
Wow. So I wanted to kind of then given, you know, you guys are getting more into the policy and adaptability thread here. I mean, as an industry then, if you know we're attracting these Olympic athletes and we have all these ski areas here, some of which are more resilient than others as far as their elevation and climate, do you think that this ski industry, I mean, the state overall has an attitude that doesn't seem to prioritize combating climate change, do you think the ski industry is really throwing its weight around properly? Given what it represents to the state and to the U.S. as far as Olympic prospects as well, has the industry been doing an adequate amount of lobbying or, like I said, throwing its weight around to mitigate this? That's open to anyone here.
It's tough for me to say. I don't know too much about that, mm-hmm. But I know that there's great organizations like Protect Our Winners that are trying to make a difference. I think the biggest importance is getting the word out there because a lot of people aren't educated, and I think if more people get educated, it'll be able to spark interest, maybe kind of on a bigger scale. And then you know, when people are more behind an issue like that, then you're able to have more of an impact and kind of make a change. So I think. You know, it's a great organization that is doing a lot. And if we can get more people kind of involved in the word out there, then that'll be great.
Do you think there's a role, though, for, you know, you guys have outsized roles as well-known athletes. Do you think there's a role or a need for direct interaction with some politicians in the state that may not understand the issues or understand the importance?
Yeah, absolutely. That's huge. Like she said, I think the lack of education and awareness is a big problem. That's where it's coming from. They don't understand that we're actually facing consequences already, like where we're skiing, how late we're skiing, that we're having to travel farther for skiing, that we're stopping skiing earlier, starting skiing later, pushing camps back. Like no one understands that that's an actual problem that's affecting all athletes.
Okay.
I'll just say something real quick, and I'm not an expert on this topic, but there recently was an opinion piece in the New York Times, and I think the title was something like, "Why Can't Rich People Save Winter?" Because, you know, if you think about the skiing industry, it does tend to skew towards wealthier people, and if the wealthier people can throw their weight and their money around, why hasn't there been more progress towards change and protections of winter? And it's a really great question. I mean, I think we haven't said any numbers yet, but it's over $1 billion contribution to our local economy here in Utah. And I think that's one way that we can get to people is the money part. The economy part of the skiing industry is really important. It's an important contributor in a number of direct and indirect ways. And so if that's one avenue through which you can get the ear of politicians and policymakers is through that economic aspect.
I'll chime in. I think it's a very complex component because you're exactly right. We have to look at the ski industry does serve to the elite. Just doesn't tend to, it just does. It's an expensive sport. There's no way I would have learned to ski had I not worked at a ski area. And my family doesn't ski because they don't make enough to work, you know, ski. So when you're in this type of industry, which is tourism industry, you do service people who have extra money to spend. And when you do that, when you go on vacation, because that's the, you know, Alta Skier gets upwards of 500,000 visitors. Snowbird gets over 500,000 visitors. I mean, we see millions of people that come here to ski Utah and ski these resorts. And they're not here to look at how much snow there. I mean, and I would say the majority of those folks are happy with any snow. They don't necessarily know the difference, the different types of snow. So it's a mentality thing. We kind of joke sometimes when people enter the canyon at Little Cottonwood Canyon, they leave their brains at the base. And because, no one can see signs or read signs, you know, everyone just stands in line, even though they have no idea what they're standing in line for. And we've all been guilty of it to some degree when we go on vacation, and it's a vacation sport. It's where people have fun. People are just antsy to get up the road and be the first in line and ski that powder. Like, they don't care what type of powder. Like, it's a mentality thing. It's a full, utter change in culture is what we're tackling here. And that is the biggest complexity here, because people don't want to be reminded that they just drove by themselves in this huge truck to get up to Alta or Snowbird or Brighton or wherever. They don't want to be reminded that, you know, that they just bought some goop that's going to help them stay energized, and it's made of, you know, contained in a plastic container, you know, and it's not recyclable. It's all, they don't, those are the, and we, again, we're all guilty of this, including myself. So until we can really figure out a strategy to change the mindset of this particular culture, and it's beyond just the ski areas, we're talking the hotels, the transportation, it has to be a movement for people to start recognizing. And once we have safety in numbers, when there's more people who understand their impact, then you can have, I do think it's great. And I definitely give kudos to all the, the athletes that stand up and ask and demand more. And we work closely with PAL. We try to advocate for things that really make sense, but it is hard to advocate for everything because I'm not by any means savvy when it comes to policy. But we do our best in what makes sense for us. Because you have to relate it back to the ski industry, and you have to relate it back to your skiers. And you don't want to alienate all your customers, even because, you know, a quarter of them from Texas and the other quarter from Northeast. And so it's a tricky line when you're in the service industry. So, but like I said, if we continue to move culturally this entire mindset, then we have the opportunity, I think, to really make an impact. If it wasn't, we don't want to see just one or two athletes from Utah going to go talk to representatives. We want to see half of Alta Ski Area pass holders behind these one or two athletes talking to representatives. And what does that take? It's a difficult thing. I'll just add one more thing. Like, in the summertime, we do a lot of stewardship work with a lot of nonprofits in Alta. To do from weed pulls to restoration, trail work. Guess how many people what percentage of those people are actual season pass holders? Less than 1%. our skiers are not interested in helping doing stewardship. I don't even really get very many, I don't get very many athletes either. Like, we get people who are living in the valley who just want to do more and learn more. They have never skied in their lives or never even been in the canyons. So how do you get some of that mindset over into the industry? Again, I don't know, but that's what I think needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say one thing. I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but activism could also start with you guys that are interested in the changing ski industry and changing snow. The representatives are elected by you. You're allowed to talk to them. I've been to Washington, D.C. multiple times to talk with our senators about changing snow from a science side, but I can't do it from an athlete side, and it's really important for them to hear those perspectives.
Yeah, I think it's hard for, like, that balance, because like we are awful for the environment. We travel so much. We like with all the wax, all the shipments of our skis. Like we fly everywhere and drive everywhere, and it's awful. So it's like we preach that we need it better, and we're the contributors like times 10.
And I think I can speak. I'll second that too. Yep.
I also fly everywhere.
Yep. I feel awful now. Yep. Jeez.
Yeah, it's hard. Well, and it doesn't mean that you can't advocate for things or be in favor of something. It's just important to know your own flaws and your own place and to try, you know, because I don't think, as long as you're aware of that, you know, because no one's perfect in any topic or any regard too. So it doesn't mean you're disqualified. It just means it's good to think about those things and to remember that when you are advocating too, because everyone's like that. You know, everyone has all of their own hypocrisies and issues too.
I think a huge part of it is education, because I mean, I've been skiing since I was two. I'm 26 now, and it's not really until recently that I've really thought even about the effects of climate change and how the seasons change so much within winter and the snow melting quickly. So I think a lot of it is just, even if you are in the sport and you see it, you don't realize what the reasons are that have been contributing. So I think the more that can kind of be brought to attention so that people have an understanding. I mean, if people in the ski industry don't even understand why, then how are people that are not in the industry going to know? So I think education is kind of the major piece that needs to improve more.
Thanks, guys. Yeah.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. If you're just joining us, today we air a forum on the impact of climate change on Utah's ski industry. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the audience.
Josh Kraft, I'm from Utah Clean Energy, so I do some work, and I'm going to cheat. I have a quick comment and then a question. That just to sort of say, I think if you're talking about politics, since we're at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, I would say it's great that Protect Our Winters is raising money to combat, you know, make this an electoral issue. Education and consciousness raising are really important, but that tends to speed up a lot more when people lose elections because of an issue. And so I think that's just one perspective I would bring my policy out, I would add. For you all, I think some people who are just coming to climate change are seeing something is very different than I remember when I first learned about climate change in high school, that this is definitely an existential crisis, and there's some serious doom and gloom. And I think that I worry the temptation at this point is that it's very easy just to turn it off. It's very easy just to go and ski. It's very easy to just go about your day. It's for all of us. And just to thinking about that as your quick reflection on how do you square the fact that this is inconvenient and it is hard with what you do every day and how you live your lives.
I'll start. so the way that I square it is, I guess growing up in Alaska, I saw the impacts of climate change long before I think a lot of people did. I mean, houses are falling into the ground because the permafrost is melting up there, and that's been happening for 20 years. And I originally got into the sustainability side, and I really give kudos to people like Maura who have taken this on as a career, but I quickly moved into science because I thought we needed the solid scientific basis and consensus in order to originally make the change and educate people and motivate people. And I agree, it's easy to sort of just say it's too much. It's overwhelming. I'm not going to deal with it. But hopefully I'm here to keep reminding people and keep the focus on changing snow, and I'll keep trying to do that. From the science side, but I can only get so far. I think we do miss the link between science and policy, and I wish that was stronger.
I also have something to add to that. You know, there's not any point anywhere in the near future where it would not be beneficial for us to cut our emissions. You know, if you're talking, we wait 50 years to do something. It could still be worse if we wait 100 years to do something. It could still be worse if you wait 150 years to do something. So there's always time to make a change, and every bit is going to help, because there is, you know, most of your climate projections that people talk about are the next 50 years, next 100 years, and it can still get way, way, way worse beyond that if we continue to go past those thresholds. So that might help a little with the doom and gloom. Like, basically, every bit helps, and it's never too late for us as a society to do better. So that's kind of the way I see it, too.
I'll just add, in kind of what Mackenzie's done, you just live it. You make it a part of every aspect of your life. I've had no choice to some degree, but but if you're from, let's say you graduate and you decide, or whatever, whatever it is you're pursuing, but you want to open your own business, or you stay within academia, your options are there the entire time to include environmental education or climate change every single step of the way. Even if you sell paper goods, like you're a manufacturer, you have the choice to include sustainability within your program, within your business. You can offset your carbon footprint. You can choose to, source your paper from FSC. You can choose to make it sourced from all post-consumer waste. Those are the sort of things. I don't think it's separate by any means. I mean, you could be a scientist, you could be a businessman, you can be a politician. It's the opportunity to include it is there, not just in what car you drive or what house you buy and if you install solar panels, but it's in every aspect. And this is why half my company kind of rolls their eyes when they see me. And I'm like, oh God, here she comes again, because she's dipping her hands. She's super nosy into everything. I'm like, it's not nosy. Literally, sustainability is everything. And that's what we have to take home.
Yeah, I think it is little things too. Like being ski racers is really unenvironmental and bad for the snow, which is contradicting. But I am like the evil person on my team that's always like complaining about this to do this for more environment, and like just so many little things. So I guess like that lets my mentality be better about it, even though I'm not helping really. Just a little bit.
I think we had one more
question. Yeah, I just had a quick question about kind of what you guys are talking about with everyday activities that individuals can do. What are some specific things that the Utah ski industry or the greater ski industry in general is doing to help fend off their own future doom, right? Like, I've heard things like Vail Resorts is trying to be carbon neutral by 2030. Is that reasonable? Are they just buying offset energy credits to offset their energy use as their energy use increases? I don't know if you guys have a specific route, and I know you're not Vail Resorts. That was kind of a pointed question. I guess, yeah, just like what can you see this Utah ski industry do for the future to help combat this issue?
Well, Rex is definitely not the worst thing. You do want to reduce your on-site energy usage and consumption as well, carbon footprint, but it's a good step in the right direction. We can't diss it by any means, but yes, a lot of the ski areas, they've created these high goals. There's within the we have this organization called National Ski Areas Association, which is kind of our blanket organization that helps us with policy and rules and guidelines for the ski industry as a whole, at least within North America. And they created a program called Climate Challenge. So over 35 or so ski areas belong to the Climate Challenge. To be a part of the Climate Challenge, you have to be doing three things. One, you have to be actually tracking your carbon footprint and doing carbon inventory. Two, you have to be creating goals and implementing something every single year to reach your goal. And then three, you have to support at an advocacy level climate or carbon reduction, both nationally and locally. So you have to have a requirement of two minimum, either letters or support of house bills or whatever it may be on an annual basis. So the ski industry is trying to identify as best of options as they can, and you do have to start thinking a little outside the box and working with partners. I know Park City has been doing a fantastic job, both within, it's nice because they've got the town, the municipality as well, and of course I got a lot of nice money, there's been some skiers that have been making great strides, including Aspen Snowmass, Vail Resorts, and other places. But it's no single entity is going to have the answer because every ski area is a little different. How we operate, who we are, our brand, the type of snow we get. And so everyone's got to find their way to do something. And yeah, that's kind of that. You can look it up online and see all the actions that they've taken.
That's Maura Livos, ecologist and director of the Alta Environmental Center, speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on February 7th, 2019. We are wrapping up the discussion there. If you missed some of the program or would like to hear the full discussion, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour podcast. This program is made in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.